Love has a podcast, and now here's the guy who's a mild banshee. I am Rob Cisternino. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to our special week two recap, where we're going to be talking with your friend and mine, Stephen Fishback, who's on the line. Stephen Fishback.
Oh my God, I've been listening in the whole time. Wow, Rob has a podcast. It has been a long time since I've been on Rob has a podcast. Obviously, I do the know-it-alls every week, but this
you're making
special.
A distinction that the know-it-alls is not Rob has a podcast.
Well, we don't get that intro. I don't get the coming. Oh yeah, yeah. You know, we get yeah. the. You know, this is exciting.
Yes, that's right.
And people do. People count it differently. Like people say, who's had the most appearances on Rob has a podcast? And I see these.
Oh, they don't count you.
Surging past me, yeah, and it's outrageous.
All right. Well, Stephen, first off, I'm very excited to talk to you today. We can actually get into things a little bit more. We're not sort of like dealing with the frantic pace of it just happening, and then we're processed and digested. I know that's very important to you. And,
yes, I need to digest.
And last night, I missed you personally on the Survivor Know-It-Alls, but I got a lot of feedback on social media. People said they actually liked it a lot better last night. Without yeah. you.
Well, I believe that. I do believe. I have been holding you back. It's like when John Lennon and Paul McCartney split up. Mm-hmm. They both went on to do, I don't know.
So Cass is like the Yoko Ono of Survivor podcasting.
Exactly. Who knew that? Yeah. You chose Cass over me and it was a fine choice. I respect that. I'm going to go on and, you know, start my own version of Wings and lead a healthy life. And you know, whatever happens, happens.
Okay. So wait, so I'm Lennon?
If Cass is Yoko and you chose
like
Cass,
you have the glasses.
you've got a beard. You're going to have glasses pretty soon.
Okay, that tickle hand man.
Yeah.
All right.
You're just slowly mimicking my you know, rakish style.
Yes. Steven, is it true that last night you missed the know-it-all so that you could attend your friend's sad birthday party?
I don't think it was I wouldn't call it sad. It was really.
Did your mom make you go to this birthday party?
Oh. You know, the fact that I missed that is clearly a function of how much fun I had at the fun birthday party. You know what? Like, I need a sanity check on the sad birthday party metaphor. That was terrible, right?
Yeah, it was terrible, but I think it speaks to how well Ryan has really integrated into this group that he can just tell this meandering story and everybody's like, yeah, I get that. Sure.
Yeah. Oh, he's so fun and awkward. Like, I feel like that's, you know, I've said this before, but there's like two versions of like the nerd on Survivor and maybe in real life. It's like the nerdy guy who's like so nerdy that we can't even like handle him, and then the nerdy guy who's like lovable in spite of his or because of his nerdiness. And I think Ryan is right now solidly in that latter category.
Well, Steven, hey, I'm glad you brought that up because you've been actually quite outspoken recently in your depiction or how the Survivor has depicted nerds over the years. And it's finally time that somebody spoke up for nerds' rights issues.
Well, thank you. You know, and it really is, you know, we're fully rounded human beings. You know, if you prick us, we bleed.
Easily.
If you pick us, we bleed extensively. It does seem like there's two primary caricatures, right? And I've said this before. There's like just, or I said it before, and by that I mean 30 seconds ago, right? There's the nerd who falls prey to his nerdiness, which was me in Cambodia, and there's the nerd who overcomes his nerdiness, which was me in Token Sheens, or you know, you get Cochran,
yeah, or Cochran. I would have gone with Cochran, yeah.
Well, the fact that I myself have had both narratives applied to me, I think, is really indicative or representative of how, you know, how clear that distinction is, right? It's like, on the one hand, you have me, you know, awkwardly reciting poetry and not able to break a branch. And on the other hand, you have me like making a fire and like triumphing over my, you know, inabilities. And I'm the same guy, you know, in both cases, I can't break a branch, mm-hmm. but you know, only one of them gets shown.
Yeah. That's what they say about nerds, though, that either you go on long enough to see yourself become a cool nerd or you go out early enough to be a nerd that is chastised.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's true of basically anybody, right? Where like any any character on the show, you know, either they're falling prey to their fundamental characteristics and going out early, or they're overcoming their fundamental.
I think you're onto something there. In turn, like, just to put, look at it from the antithesis of that, where if you have this person who's sort of like this athletic jock, you come into the season thinking they're going to be one way, but then the people that really do succeed turn out to be sort of like a like fully formed three-dimensional character that has like depth and more to their personality. So I guess
but
it's true.
But jocks don't get growth edits. Jocks don't get like oh, you finally overcame your muscles.
Not that you overcame your muscles, but that you also had some smarts to you as well.
Right, right. Yeah. I feel like when the jocks have smarts, it's not presented as this like miracle in the way that when like the nerd is able to make fire, it's like, oh my God, how did that happen?
Yeah. All right. Well, Steven, a lot to get into here from last night's episode. Looking forward to getting your take on everything. Couple of programming notes up front. One, we are just 2 weeks away from being together back in person in Reno, Nevada at Jason Somerville's Run It Up Reno event. We'll be doing the Survivor viewing and live know-it-alls. And that is completely free and open to the public, courtesy of what Jason Somerville has going on at the Peppermill Resort. For more information on that, go to runitupreno.com. And Steven, I know, is itching to get back to the poker table.
Yeah. I played some poker last night, too. I did not go very well. I didn't go very well. And I'm soured on the whole thing now. But maybe with Jason's tutelage. Jason's, you know, he's such a cool guy because, like, he's such just like an incredibly nice guy. He's obviously a big Survivor fan. He also just gives, like, the most thoughtful, patient, introspective advice about playing poker. Like if I were a poker master, I would want to, you know, think about the game the way that Jason Somerville does.
Right. Like when people ask you for Survivor advice, you are not nearly as patient. You are much more dismissive. Yeah. Like,
Here's a link. Like, I've said this before. Yeah.
Here's the link to the podcast. Here's the link to my blog. Go do the research. Come back to me.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the other big news that we have coming out, that the highly anticipated follow-up to our genius audiobook is on the way, Stephen Fishback.
I'm really excited about this because the Genius is like one of the most fun shows to talk about, I think. And just like there's just crazy characters, big moments, you know, like interesting games to dissect. You know, when we talk about Survivor, you know, we are talking about Survivor with this like huge history of having talked about Survivor for years and years and years. So that's interesting in and of itself. But there's something really fun and fresh, too, about talking about a game that is kind of new, you know, both to us and to the players. So if you didn't listen to our first season Genius recap, you know, here's a link somewhere.
GeniusKIA.com.
And the second one dropping soon.
The first one, we released it in December. We recorded it over the summer. It has been in the post-production queue for quite some time here at Rob at the Podcast, through no fault of Stephen Fishback.
Thank you for specifying.
I will throw you under the bus when appropriate, but this had nothing to do with Stephen in terms of getting it out to you guys. And so on Monday, we will have the second season released in audiobook format. There you go. So check out the first season if you are so inclined at geniuskia.com. Season two to come. All right. So, Steven, episode two of Survivor Heroes versus Healers versus Hustlers was out. And, of course, I read your People blog, and I thought you did a fantastic job as usual. You talked about the idea that when survivors have the choice to get rid of one of two players, always go for the player who is more inconspicuous, the player that can blend into the scenery better rather than the person who everybody is going to notice. And that's why you felt like that the Hustlers made the right decision by getting rid of Simone over the person that you referred to as the hopped up human Tigger, Patrick.
I want
there's
that on
a crab
soundboard
in my pants.
One thing that is fun about having talked about Survivor for so many years is it's kind of fun to extrapolate like what should be somewhat general rules. And we've done that a little bit with, you know, how the idol should be played and, you know, how different alliances function. But it does seem I think this ends at a certain point in the game, right? Maybe towards the end, this is not as true anymore, but certainly early in the game, you always want to keep around the more conspicuous player because that person is always going to be drawing attention to themselves. And that person is therefore always going to be a potential target at tribal council. And I wrote about this a little bit in my blog, but like one of the ways to get to the end in Survivor, or in fact, the only way to get to the end in Survivor is to not be voted out, which is, you know, somewhat intuitive, but also, you know, there's only a limited number of votes on Survivor. And, you know, you've got a ton of different people you want to vote out for different reasons. And the three final people sitting there are basically just the ones you never got around to. You know, you always want to vote everyone out and you have an order. And the ones who make it to the end are just the ones who were never at the top of that list for whatever reason. You know, every week, every tribal council, they were just never the ones at the very top of the list for who you wanted to vote out. And so someone like Patrick, he's going to like always be at the top of the list because he's so big and he's got, you know, so much energy and he's so apparently annoying. So, yeah, I mean, keeping him around, you know, is just going to make sure you're always one spot further down that list. What do you think?
I really like what you're saying. And actually, I know you are not a Big Brother watcher, but I feel like that this type of thinking is, you know, more part and parcel with Big Brother strategy of the idea of when there are two people sitting up on the block, okay, you know, this guy is going to end up back on the block. Somebody else is going to have an issue with him. Whereas Simone, if we don't get her out now, if we don't take the shot at her, you know, she may be able to just get back under the radar. So I like what you're saying. It also goes in line with your signature move from Survivor Cambodia, where you targeted Kelly Wigglesworth, somebody who easily could have been under the radar. But tell me, Stephen Fishback, how do Carolina and Sandy get targeted by you in the pregame of Survivor Token Chains? Is it because you didn't think of this strategy yet?
Yeah. Carolina, my God. She was just so annoying. I think it was because we just hadn't thought of the strategy.
You didn't like this yet.
Token Chains was, I mean, you know, and also this is not like some great invention. I think this is very similar to Jeremy and his meat shields. You know, I think Tony was really good at this. But I think it's worth codifying to a certain degree at this point. Token Chains was really the dark. I mean, it's like old school by now. I mean, next season, it's the halfway point of the show, which is crazy. A very different game that was played back then than is played now, I think.
Was it not until you played with an outlandish character like Coach that you said, oh, okay, I get it. You need to keep the crazy people around and vote out all the quiet people.
I mean, we were voting people out in the order that we thought they would be likely to win votes. But the thing was, I mean, I actually do think this comes down to a way the game has changed, Rob. Back then, alliances were really rigid. So your alliance was going to vote with you. You know, I didn't have any fear that like Aaron or Taj or JT were suddenly going to start voting with Coach because they now saw me as the threat or they saw JT as a threat. So like Aaron and Taj were going to team up with, you know, Debbie and Coach for one vote to get rid of JT, and then I would be in trouble. You know, that wasn't part of anybody's calculus at that time, which is somewhat crazy. But, you know, it just the way people conceived of the game, which is what we call the metagame, just totally was totally different. Now, given a world where, you know, every vote is a different series of people coming together, I guess the word would be voting blocks. I think you have to think about the game a little bit differently, and therefore keeping kind of a roster of threats around as opposed to getting that roster of threats out is a little bit more pressing.
Great. Well, let's talk about that metagame idea. And I have a question for you from Kerry Graveline, who says, do you foresee voting blocks coming into play this season? And I know that there is always, we do it somewhat tongue in cheek, but there's always like, that's the easiest thing to attack us on is voting blocks. If you want to make fun of just how nerdy we are on this show. But Steven, do you see that as a legitimate thing that's going on this season? We have a lot of pairs and couples and people targeting couples very quickly off the bat. We have Ryan and Devin, who are now a secret pair. We have Chrissy and Ben, who are working together as a secret pair. We have Ashley and JP, who are more of an outward identified pair, which are immediately sort of labeled power couple. We have also Cole and Jessica coming together as somewhat of a more conspicuous pair. Do you feel like that this is now officially a thing on Survivor? People are coming into Survivor and immediately looking to pair up based on this idea of, okay, that I need to form a block, even though if it's not something that they're specifically looking at it that clinically. But that's sort of where the strategy has gone.
Yeah, and I agree with you that the phrase voting blocks is a little bit, you know, like any of these phrases. I mean, that's the, you know, in my opinion, that's the least ridiculous of all the different phrases for the same basic concept,
right?
Which is this sort of like fracturing of these long-standing, like, and really rigid alliances.
When Shane Powers is coming after you on Twitter, that's like the top of mind, right?
Yeah, he's really upset about the voting blocks.
I have to disavow you, I think.
Yeah, okay. When I said this like somewhat of a benign comment to him, I did think, you know what? There's a chance that Shane is going to either misinterpret it or I don't know. I don't know what the other, you know.
He came for your wig.
Yeah. And I thought, you know what? If that happens, I'm okay with it. So I went ahead and posted a comment.
I can't even repeat on the podcast what he said about you on Twitter.
It was so over the top. And basically, like, Shane had made a remark about, for those of you who are not, you know, avidly following all of the Survivor Twitter drama. Shane made a remark, Steven. Yeah, about the urologist and like how he was like, you know, a joke character or something. And I responded like, oh, I would think you of all people would really value a urologist on Survivor. Making perhaps a somewhat obscure reference to Shane's like famous rash. You know, it was one of his big scenes on the show where he like had Ceri look at his rash and she confirmed that it was, you know, everything was fine.
The part that I resent was the uninteresting Survivor gameplay panel.
But he wasn't talking about your panels. He was like other panels, I think. You know,
you're
there was
on
like,
other panels?
Maybe he was proposing one.
What are you doing? A TED talk? A big TED talk?
Here's the thing that like the, and again like
don't bring me down with you, okay?
Well, I don't,
voting blocks, go back to the voting blocks.
I think that the way that players conceive of the game has changed. You know, I do think that everyone still loves alliances, we all want alliances, but I think it is much more fluid now for the most part. And I think some of that is encouraged, right, by production and the questions that they ask you and the, you know, because to a certain degree, the way that anybody is actually perceiving the game itself is influenced by the questions they're getting asked. Are you in an alliance with, you know, so-and-so? Or, you know, are you thinking of betraying so-and-so? You know, inherently, that dialogue is shaping the way that you see the game itself. But then, of course, then it's aired on TV in a certain way, right? With these very fluid alliances. So these players, some of whom are really big fans and want to play the game that they're seeing on TV, others of whom are recruits and are just seeing a couple of seasons. Like it may even be more the case for recruits where their whole like frame of reference is going to be, you know, the seasons that they're watching. So I do think that the whole way that people perceive the game is shifting. You know, there's something fundamentally reassuring and necessary about alliances. And I would imagine that's particularly true for new players where they're going to want that stability but I think those strong bonds that we had in token chains are probably not as rigid anymore. I mean, what's your perspective? Does that sound like nonsense?
No, that I understand what you're saying. I agree with it. So what I'm wondering is that are we going to have a season where maybe these first four votes, where before we get to a swap, we had a unanimous vote for Katrina and a unanimous vote against Simone? Will we see pretty straightforward votes for these next couple of weeks? And will this be a season that's really not going to kick into gear until we get to a swap where we have some of the power couples or some of the couples that are broken up, some of them end up together, and then some of them end up actually pairing up, and that's where we get our alliances of, you know, five or six that are going to dominate the action post-merge?
Yeah, I believe that. I absolutely believe that. I mean, because even when you're seeing these like down the line votes, you're also not seeing, you know, super strong alliances within that. You know, to a certain degree, the tribal vote doesn't mean that, you know, there aren't, that the group isn't like riven by factions. So I think I would guess that you're absolutely right. I mean, the thing that I think is really interesting that you said is like the idea that people come in now seeking a pair more than they actually come in seeking an ally or seeking an alliance. Like, do you think that's true, that people are looking for their one rather than their five now?
It might be a product of, you know, we've had all these seasons where it's like, okay, well, I'm going to be in a group of six. I know that my group of six is not going to carry the day. Maybe right. You would think that if you were in a group of 10, where you'd be more inclined to, you know, pull out like a, try to find a four or five that you would work with. But it's like, okay, I know that there's going to be a swap in a couple of days, and then who knows what's going to happen after the merge. The one thing that I can sort of bank on is if I end up really like pairing up with somebody here in this first part of the game, that'll get me through this. Who knows what happens after the swap, but hopefully I can get back together with my pair. And I guess there's a 50-50 shot that I end up swapping with them post the, you know, the, instead of maybe they might do sending you to one of three tribes, or if they go down to two tribes, there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to end up stuck together. So, I mean, I do think it makes sense. I don't know if anybody's like putting it up on the whiteboard and thinking about it in that way, but it does make sense based on the way the game has gone.
I think so. That's interesting. Yeah, it sure does seem like that. And it's also, you know, we've seen over the last few seasons, you know, a lot of pairs coming together and being really effective as pairs. You know, I mean, David and Ken, you know, the two of those guys.
Mm-hmm. And just let's take a look at the Heroes tribe specifically, where there was all this talk about, okay, there's the core four, and then we're going to, you know, target the two moms, and then they get rid of one of the moms, and then, you know, it's basically the core four couldn't even last 4 days. So Ben is like, okay, well, I had my pair with Alan and he's too unstable, so now I have to switch up my pair and go with Chrissy. It's not like, okay, well, now Chrissy is in the alliance and this person is out. It's only about who is my person that is my close, you know, BFF.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I think that's 100% correct. And, you know, you see it from almost everyone. Like JP is, you know, now he's looking to Chrissy too, right? He thought, well, I thought Ashley was my number one, but actually now that we've been outed as a power couple, I need to be part of a new couple. And it's not just that tribe either. You know, I think we certainly saw it on the Hustlers. You know, Ryan and Devin is the obvious example. You know, when we had it with Patrick and Ali, of course, you know, there's obviously, you know, more history there. Mm-hmm. And then we don't really know as much about the healers, although you certainly pointed out the Cole Jessica
well
alliance.
It does feel like that in each group of six, that I'm not sure if we can confine it to this season, but in a survivor group of six, what you end up with is a pair and then two stragglers, and then the two pairs pick which straggler they want to keep.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, and some of that, you know, maybe just like somewhat narrative convenience. I mean, my experience in Cambodia on the six was just that there was, you know, everyone had 10 different alliances, right?
What about when you were in the group of six in Cambodia? Could you relate to this at all? I mean, so what were the pairings there? Was it that Jeremy ended up being so effective because he kind of had multiple people that felt like that they were his closest ally in the group?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard because I think it's different when you start on a six-person tribe versus when you start on a 10-person tribe. What about when you were on a six-person tribe?
Well, I mean, take a look at how that ended up playing out.
Sure.
Where you had a two people that paired up there in that group of six. And then, I mean, Tom ultimately felt like that him and Boston Rob were also a pair. And so that was sort of like that Rob had basically two different pairs. Alicia and Sue ended up being a pair. And then when you look at it that way, you know, I'm the straggler there where, you know, it's not like that, the Rob and Amber pair was going to part with Big Tom. So they decided which pair they were going to keep in the short term. So when you look at it that way, yeah, it definitely does make sense that I'm the person that people want to get rid of.
Yeah, for so many reasons.
For a lot of reasons. Steven, I want to talk to you about what's going on with Ryan and Devin. A lot of people have been making the comparison to you and JT, calling them, they're like JT and Steven, but likable, Ryan and Devin. So, there is something interesting about this sort of dynamic that you guys really patented back in Survivor Token Genes. Jeff Probst talked about it in his interviews today, that he said that if he was playing the game, that he would try to do what Ryan and Devin have done, where he would go ahead and find someone that complements the way, the things that he doesn't have, and keep that as sort of a pairing that's on the DL.
That's interesting. I think that's probably, I think that's like a smart way to play, right? I think you want someone that you feel good working with, but also someone who does kind of, you know, bring some other perspective to the table, and especially who can work well with people who you might not work particularly well with. And I think that was what was so effective about me and JT. And I think it's also probably what could be so effective about Ryan and Devin, is this idea that like Devin is more bro-y. He's going to like, you know, maybe have a better and easier time relating to, I don't know, Patrick, I don't know, someone bro-y. Right. And this, you know, Ryan is more strategic. You saw him and Allie talking. And I think, and then they can come back and kind of exchange notes. It does not actually seem like Ryan cares to exchange notes with Devin, right? Most of his confessionals are about how he wants someone that he, who is predictable, who he can manipulate. It doesn't sound like he actually wants, you know, a partner who he can bounce ideas off of.
I don't know. I mean, he did go to him pretty early in one of the secret scenes from this week. Devin is actually speaking really glowingly about Ryan, about how he wants to go to the end with him, how he's like a beautiful person and he loves him so much. So, you know, I do think that that's an interesting pair, where I too was a little bit more skeptical about what Ryan's intentions were with Devin, but it does seem like there is a bromance happening, Steven.
Yeah, well, just because Devin says nice things about Ryan doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, Ryan feels the same way. I'm sure there's a bromance happening, but I mean, there was a really, it made the show too. It was one of my favorite scenes, and unfortunately I didn't get the chance to write about it, was when Devin and Ryan are talking, and Devin says, you know, when I talk to other, strategize with other people, I have a frown on my face. Mm-hmm. But when I strategize with you, Ryan, I'm smiling. And that's how I know, you know. And it's like, I just love this idea that, you know, Devin is such a, you know, a naive, that he's just like, the very fact of his delight and his happiness around Ryan is, you know, more of a benchmark for him than any kind of like strategic success they may or may not be having.
Right.
I like the romance. It seems like Devin is more delighted by their strategic parity, whereas for Ryan, it seems like it's more, I want to use this guy and go as far as I can. I'm sure he also is, you know, it's never one thing or the other, though.
Yeah, Steven, going back to your people blog from this week, you referred to Joe as a Tony Vlachos impersonator. And I think that there's something interesting here with, you know, we've made all of the Tony parallels between Joe and Tony. And now ultimately you have Joe out there finding the idol. And, you know, if you weren't paying attention and you walked into the room and you saw Joe running through the jungle, you would think, oh, Tony is back this season also. You wouldn't have known, you know. Yeah. In the WWE, I know what a big wrestling fan you are. There was a point where Kevin Nash and Razor Ramon left the WWE in the 90s. And then they just brought in guys who look like them and then just said they were them.
Really?
Do you? Yeah. Yes.
That's amazing.
It was not popular. It was not well received. Wow. It was not well received. And so, but do you think, like, is this a good idea for Survivor? Instead of like finding people that are in the same archetype, like should they find the 22-year-old construction worker from Boston who's a Red Sox fan who wears a Red Sox hat on the island, and just like should they just be looking to reboot Survivor?
Well, I think that's always been part of the DNA of the show, is that they cast somewhat in terms of archetypes, right?
And, but forget, you know, archetypes.
Well, like, it is literally more specific. Right.
This is the reboot. This is like a different actor playing Captain Kirk.
So we'll get a new, you just like do the first season, we'll get a new Sue Hawk, a new right. Richard. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Let's find the new Richard Hatch. Not somebody who's like Richard Hatch, but basically somebody who acts and looks like him.
And do you prompt that person to be more Hatch-like, or do you kind of like hope that it happens naturally?
Oh, well, I think you hope that, you know, you want to be a little organic about it. You find somebody who looks like him and acts like him, and then hopefully you put them out there and then you get the same sort of magic.
I would watch Survivor Doppelgangers. I mean, that would be really fun. I would 100% watch that show.
A look-alike season of Survivor. Because, you know, the problem is, you know, Survivor is, you know, 17 years old. People age. They don't look the same. You know, you don't want to see somebody like you remember as, like, you know, the young hot stud, and they can come back with, like, a, you know, a beer belly and gray hair, and it's like, hold on, where's the guy from 2003?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about myself. And so you could maybe like have this season of people who are the, you know, timeless version, the lookalike version of these people.
Yeah, and the first time out too. I mean, you know, the problem too with these returning players is that they're either like working harder for airtime, or they're being basically pastiches of what we saw on television, you know, like Tony last season with just the spy bunker and all that. You know, they lose and you know, Coach obviously in Heroes versus Villains, you know, they lose some of that freshness that's so exciting. I really love this idea.
Because the Tony impersonator isn't jaded like Tony might be.
Yeah, right. And he's also not, you know, Tony himself is always going to be a giant target, whereas the Tony impersonator might not be as big a target.
Like, well, he's not actually Tony.
Right. You know, if they were to do a season, I think they should do Cagayan. Cagayan is always the one season where I felt I would actually watch that entire cast come and play again. And even better if it's lookalikes of the entire cast.
Yeah. Do you like Survivor Doppelgangers?
Survivor Doppelgangers. I'm into it. I think that could be the next big twist.
Okay. I like this. Like, do we need the real people out there on the beach? Like, you remember these people. Well, now meet their doppelgangers. Or is it like some sort of a blood versus water season where it's like Rupert is playing with the Rupert doppelganger?
And only one can exist in this reality.
Yeah. And then they have to face off like when there were two Captain Kirks.
Yeah, no, I think that would be good. I think that would be like, and it's like he kicked him in the knee, right?
Vote out the fake Rupert. Oh, vote him out. Which one? I'm so confused.
Yeah, what's the solution? How do you figure out which is the real
one? I'm not a bot. Okay. I don't know. Okay. Steven, but I want to talk about this whole saga going on with Joe and the idol. And I was talking about last night on the Know It Alls. This is something that you did not discuss in your People blog, which I thought was a kind of a big oversight on your part.
Yeah.
That did Cole make the wrong move by telling Joe where he thought the actual idol was?
I mean, then you're like judging Cole on the basis of like, did Cole make the right or the wrong move? I mean, clearly he, you know what? Like, I didn't even consider the possibility that I should be assessing his gameplay that way. I mean,
what do you do for? I'd call it a living, but it's probably more like a hobby for you. Yeah. Isn't that what you do?
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, it's like Cole's like, you know, he's on the raft, he's laughing, he's like barely verbal. You know, I like Cole, but I'm not like, you know, from my perspective, it's like, what did Joe do? You know, did Joe make the right or the wrong move here? Did Cole make the right or the wrong move? It's an interesting question. I think Cole made the right move. I think that if Cole, you know, what's Cole going to do? You know, oh, I don't know. I don't understand this. Then he goes by himself and finds the idol. Then, like, you know, Joe's super paranoid about it. You know, I mean, Joe's going to be super paranoid either way. What was your verdict? What did you and Cass decide?
Well, I said that I thought that he definitely made the wrong decision. That you say, oh, boy, I don't know. I think you're right? Like, I was in the raft. I mean, the only reason why you say that maybe he made the wrong move is because he identifies that Joe is, like, super paranoid about stuff. And Joe is going to say, wait, hold on. This idol clue says it was in the ocean. Cole was in the ocean. He must have the idol.
Yeah. Yeah, but Cole's going to think, I mean, Joe's going
to
think
it's so easy
that
to find an idol 5 feet in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that given Joe's frame of reference at that time, he was so sure that was the raft. What I loved about this moment was that Joe took the most absurd leaps in logic, and yet it somehow brought him to the right place. Somehow he does end up with the idol, even though he's taking these giant leaps in logic that have nothing to do with where the idol actually is. Yeah, I mean, you're right that if Cole denied it, Joe would be super suspicious of Cole, just like he's super suspicious of Dr. Mike. Maybe, though, you could argue that managing Joe's suspicion is basically an impossible task. It's like trying to manage Abby's rage. Just like, don't even bother. Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. I'm convinced that.
Oh, wow. You rarely concede a point to me on anything.
Well, you're just so rarely right. But in this strange situation, you know, I think you are correct that Cole should have not said anything. Found the idol.
Right, because where is this going next? Now you have super paranoid Joe who's going to say, okay, now look, he doesn't have the Tony voice, but he's going to say, okay, only one person knows I have the idol and it's Cole. I need to kill him off because then there's no witnesses to the fact that I have the idol. So if I take him out of the game now, then I'll be safe and I'll have the idol and nobody will know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. And I think that's obviously the danger that Cole is facing right now. I mean, I think from Cole's perspective, what he wants to do is build bonds with people, and that's a really, really valid strategy, and especially at this point in the game, rather than, you know, immediately go backstabbing someone, betraying someone for the idol, which is not that useful a tool, you know, as we've discussed. It's so situational that, you know, unless you're really positive that you're going home, which is really hard to be because the whole point is that people are going to blindside you, you know, it's not that useful. But building an alliance with someone and sharing that moment of discovery and helping someone out, that could actually, you know, be better for you in the long term. The problem is that, you know, who he's doing it with. It is Joe's paranoia. Joe isn't going to necessarily look at Cole as his new ally. Sure, it seems like Joe is more going to conceive of him as a threat. So in the abstract, I don't hate Cole's decision, but I guess it all comes down to specifics. And I think you're right about that.
One of the things I commended Cole on during the know-it-alls last night was that I like that he cut the idol clue out of the tree after the fact. I thought that was good. I do apologize to the person who said this to me. I try to keep track of this stuff when I can. But somebody had said to me on social media that no, that was a bad move by Cole, because what he could have done was hide a fake idol where somebody could have found it. And I was thinking about this, and I think something interesting has happened with the fake idol. And tell me if you agree with this or not, because back in the early days of the fake idol, going back to probably the most famous fake idol there is, when Ozzy makes a stick and hides it and makes Jason Siska find it, it seems like the value of the fake idol isn't just a fun prank to play on people. You want to be in possession of a fake idol rather than have the fake idol be something that some rube finds and then plays it at a imperfect point. You want to be the person who is in possession of that so that you can use it as a bargaining chip. David Wright makes a fake idol which he plants for Jay to find at the final six, but that's a very specific point in the game where that was the person that they were targeting. So I think that might be a little bit of an exception, but do you agree with that it's more valuable to have a fake idol in your possession than to plant it where just anybody's going to find it?
That's interesting. So, in fact, if he is going to make a fake idol, he should just use it as a fake idol as an idol proxy rather than letting somebody else find it. I mean, I think it's, if you have, right, I think the point is more like the fake idol is useful.
And the David Wright thing was very specific in that it was that there was going to be an idol hidden on the beach, and by getting Jay to find the fake idol, then that kept him from going out to find the real idol. I think that's a very specific circumstance. But just in general of, okay, well, let's put the clue going to a fake idol there when you have the real idol, I think it's more valuable to me just the concept of okay, like Chrissy has a fake idol. She can do stuff with that.
She can do stuff. You're right. Like, apart from that David Wright thing, have we actually seen that much stuff happen with a fake idol? You know, it's a pretty, like, I guess, like, then in that case, you can use the fake idol as a tool to, like, build an alliance or as a, I mean, the fake idol double cross would be really tricky to pull off.
Survivor is thirsty for some fake idol action.
Yeah, it is. It is. They're really laying, certainly with Debbie or with Cochran having the fake idol kit to give Debbie. What do you think about this? Have we really gone into this? Because I am kind of on the fence about how I feel about having these fake idols in the game that are essentially handcrafted idols. Yeah. But like, and if there's an, if it comes with a piece of parchment, which you can get from a real idol, suddenly this fake idol, there's no way for a player to distinguish the fake idol from a real idol. It's made by production, craftsmen. If you have that letter, then you've got the parchment. And as a result, there's no way for the person who has a fake idol to necessarily know that their idol is fake. And I don't necessarily have a problem with it. There's just something that makes me kind of uncomfortable about it.
I agree with what you're saying. It's a slippery slope, whereas, back in the day, okay, so Ozzy is turning a stick into an idol, and Jason Siska, what a moron that he fell for that. Bob Crowley ends up, like, really artfully creating something that could be an idol, and gets Randy to use it, and we say, wow, what a great job by Bob Crowley. And so then we have survivors like David Wright. He's gathering the paint and he's trying to put these materials together to be able to craft a fake idol. But then now we have at the point where Survivor has been playing with, okay, well, we'll try to make the idols look really crappy so that, okay, sometimes you won't really know. And now we're saying, like, okay, no, now we're going to actually make fake idols that look the same as the real one. But I do think that production is really looking for there to be uncertainty surrounding the idols in any way. But I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, because where I think you're diminishing the power of the idol if that people are saying, okay, well, maybe 70% of the time it's not going to be a real idol, whereas I think it's the fear of the idol being played is what creates the instability. And then I guess that you are sort of like increasing the odds that somebody could have a fake that people mistake as a real, but I think at the same time you are diminishing the effect of the real, because there's going to be some portion of time that people think it's the fake, but I guess then they'll look stupid. So I guess that'll be good TV.
Yeah, and I think that's a really astute point, is that it makes the idol itself or hypothetically, if people actually do start using these fake idols, it would make the idol itself more suspect and therefore like a less interesting tool within the game.
I just want to talk that through because, okay, so let's say that I think that your idol is fake that you're going to play. And I say, you know what? We're putting the votes on Steven still. I think his idol is fake. And then I get voted out because you played that idol. I guess, isn't that a good TV moment?
I guess that's right. And well, that was the other thing I was going to say, and kind of what you just said, basically, is that it's really privileging the TV viewers over the contestants, which is what they should be doing, right? It's a TV show. But it's like it creates a somewhat impossible situation for a contestant. I mean, as a game player myself, I don't like rules that, you know, I want the game to give the contestants a chance to like figure out its own mechanics, right? If someone, you know, I would want as a player a way to know, to be able to figure out that this fake idol was a fake idol. But as a viewer, of course I want more big moments and more chaos in the game and like more, you know, stunts happening and more trickery. So as they should, the producers, I think, are privileging the viewers over the players. And, you know, there's 10 million viewers and 20 players. So, or 18 players. Yeah, I think you're right that it's going on this slippery slope where it's less about the really excellent handiwork done by a few enterprising contestants and more about like the game really trying to encourage this type of play.
Right. And I think you're going to ultimately get more moments, but I think that the idol itself as leverage is going to be diminished in value. It's almost like if we're playing Monopoly and then there's like $2,500 in fake money that's in the game and in counterfeit money that's in the game. And now we're like making trades for stuff. Now, I think there'd be less trading going on because I don't know necessarily if that $1,000 that, you know, you want me to mortgage one of my properties. I know that I'm getting the Monopoly rules all screwed up, but I feel like that I'm less likely to want to make a deal because I have no way of deciphering if the thing being exchanged is real or counterfeit, even though that we're still going to get those big moments where it's like, oh, that $1,000 is counterfeit, you idiot.
Well, let me lay a counterpoint on you, which is that I think people are more secretive about their idols than they used to be. And so maybe as a result of that, there's less deal making that goes on around the idols than there used to be. And that these fake idols are a way to encourage more kind of wheeling and dealing with this basically, you know, meaningless symbol that meaning is only what the people believe it is. But, you know, so I mean, what do you think of that? Like at that point, it's encouraging more interaction between the contestants where the idol itself has become something that you just kind of like put in your sock and save for a rainy day.
Okay. So because there are fake idols in the mix that look like real idols, that the person who is showing off their idol is more likely to have a fake idol. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that contestants have over the last few seasons been less likely to share their idols, I think. I mean, I'm not sure if that actually tracks, but like that's been my perception is that there's more of a sense of I've got the idol. I need to hide this, you know, whereas back in the day, you know, it was like, I've got the idol. This is a tool for me to use to build an alliance. You know, we did see some of that in Millennials versus Gen X. But I think overall, it's like more like I've got the idol. I'm not going to tell anybody about it. And as a result, you know, some of these fun moments and interactions are gone, whereas making these fake idols leads to more just kind of like fun, interesting, strategic interactions between the players.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to just have to see how it all plays out. I get the sense that, you know, they've made such a big deal about this idol that Chrissy has and sort of like from when Ryan had it, Chrissy talked about it. I have a feeling that this is going to come up during the course of this season. So we'll have to wait and see how it plays out. Steven, one other really interesting observation I thought you had in your People blog, and I'd like to talk that through, that you said that Survivor winners throw up while Survivor losers defecate.
Don't you think that's true? I was trying to think of, because as soon as Simone was talking about her aqua dump, I was like, oh my, this person is not winning this game. You know, you don't see the winners talk about pooping themselves. And then I thought,
hold on, you are adding to that. Nobody talked about pooping themselves except you.
Okay. Sorry. Then let me change that. Then you don't see the winners pooping ever. Right. I mean, I had to go back. I had this vague recollection that maybe Ethan had like that sort of experience. Mm-hmm. And so I asked Wiggler and he said he was pretty sure that Ethan did. So, I mean, but that was a very long time ago and certainly in a very different way than the show was edited. On the other hand, you have winners throwing up all the time. And I do think there's a difference in terms of like how we perceive it culturally. Okay. Like, oh, go ahead.
Well, you are an author, Stephen. So tell us, you know, from a literal perspective, and I mean, as somebody in the literary arts, I mean, is there some symbolism behind a person vomiting that you do not get from a person defecating?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's necessarily symbolism, but I do think there's something like about vomiting. It's like, oh, I've consumed too much, you know, whether it's alcohol or scorpions, like so much that my body is exploding outwards. It's like almost like manly, you know, mm-hmm. where like I have drunk too much of life and now I will hurl it back in your face. But versus defecating, it seems like it's more a sign of like, oh, my weak body couldn't handle this. And now I'm like, you know, do you think that's true? I mean,
is this the smartest or the dumbest conversation we've ever had?
I think it's probably the dumbest. I mean, I don't know if this, I mean, I think there's something there, right? Right. Like where
it's interesting. It definitely is interesting.
Yeah, and again, there's something now, like somewhat embarrassing about pooping, which is like crazy. Cause like everybody poops, throws up. Yeah. But, you know,
and again, we're not talking about like in the actual 39 days, I'm sure every winner has gone to the bathroom number two, but the fact that it's in the show, what does it mean? And we've seen a couple of contestants in recent memory, you know, discussing this bodily function.
You're thinking of Darnell.
Yes. And yeah. That it is something that seems to be a harbinger of some more number two happening to them, you know?
Well, my gut tells me go use the bathroom.
By the way, I was watching the secret scenes, and there's a secret scene with Patrick and Ryan, and there is like gratuitous graphic, like close up of Patrick vomiting. Like, it's like this was really. I was wow, not
winner's edit. Yeah,
is that winner edit? So, are you feeling that you're putting your chip on Chrissy? Then you feel like this season.
Oh wait, hold on. The one thing I wanted to say about the pooping thing is that I saw a number of people were saying, oh my God, like, why is Simone talking about that? You know, all of the players talk about it, you know, because A, it's kind of important even just from like a logistical perspective of like, okay, I'm going over there to do my business, you know, and then also it's just, you know, something that's kind of like funny about the experience is that the struggles to do these things that are basically trivial in our daily lives. So everyone for the most part talks about this. You know, so Simone isn't unusual in that respect. It's just the fact that it got shown on air. So I'm sorry, you were saying about Chrissy?
No, well, Chrissy is the player this season who we saw throw up on this show. Do you feel like that's a good omen for her?
Sorry, I thought that was a total tangent.
No.
It could be. I mean, it really could be. I like Chrissy. I like her odds, you know. And there's who do you like this season so far?
Well, I feel like that the Chrissy and Ben pair, I feel really good about them. I really do like Ryan as well. And I feel like that him and Devin have looked really good. And then in terms of the healers, I came in feeling like really strong about all of the healers, but I haven't been overwhelmed by it. They've been good in the challenges, but I haven't been blown away by anything that's happening at the healer beach in terms of any specific player.
Yeah, I mean, I like Joe and I like Dr. Mike.
Allie, also, who won the fishy last night, I thought really emerged in the second episode as well.
Yeah, I really like Allie. And even in the first episode, they had the seeds, you know, of her and Patrick. And we've talked about how she and Patrick are, you know, they know each other from before. But she really did at least seem to be considering the possibility of voting him out, which I liked.
But either way, one way or the other, that if she is going to cut him, okay, well, now she is somebody who's at a disadvantage, that she does not have that pair that she can trust implicitly like these other people, like Ryan and Devin, like Ben and Chrissy. And then if she does keep him in the game, she has the human Tigger with her, you know, knocking over the honey the rest of the season and running away from crabs. Not good.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, you know, he'll be voted out before she will, right? So as long as he's around, she's somewhat safe.
Not if the players are playing by your rules, Steven.
True. Well, but my rule is like she should keep him so that he's a distraction from her. You know, are the other people going to make? I mean, ultimately, any rule of good gameplay is relying on other people making subpar decisions.
Yeah. All right, Steven, let me give you some rapid fire questions. Okay.
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
Okay. Let me start with Aubrey, who asks, Steven, how did you feel about the token team's snub in the immunity challenge? Were you as upset as I was that Brazil did not seem to be on the map?
You know, Brian, I saw Brian Corden was really up in arms that Guatemala wasn't
what
there.
A shocker.
Yeah. I you know what, token chains is so fundamental to the game that it doesn't need to be on the map. You know, it's there in subtext.
Yeah. Steven, Kerry Graveline wants to know that are you inviting all of the RHAP patrons to your wedding? Now, Steven, first of all, I don't think I've ever congratulated you on the air for your engagement the off season.
Finally found someone who, you know, would accept me.
Yes. So yeah. So I just want to say that congratulations, Mazel Tov to you.
Thank you.
And your fiance.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yes, that you had tweeted this summer that what survivor is going to officiate your wedding? Have you narrowed it down?
Probably not a survivor. It was mostly that for me was mostly like a setup to like ridicule my friends who,
a roast.
Yeah.
Yes. So would you officiate the wedding of Cole and Jessica if they last?
Yeah, absolutely.
JP and Ashley, which showman?
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't look like JP and Ashley is really long for this world. Emma, Purple Rock Emma from the Purple Rock podcast, I guess she probably has a real name, said about
it's probably Emma.
Yeah. Said about JP, like looking at JP is what I imagine people with like trouble recognizing faces feel whenever they look at anybody. I thought that was very astute. He does. His face is sort of like
he has a
blur,
forgettable face,
like just like a generic blur. Yeah.
And things like that. Yeah. Okay. Trent C has a hot take to float past you. We're going to have a mini hot take off in the voicemail podcast with Akiva. Mini hot take. Patrick will hurt himself and be medevaced from the game.
Oh, that's interesting. I think that they've set him up too much as like a human for him to be for that to be the case. I mean, it certainly looks like he might be headed in that direction with all of this. What if he faces off against a crab? You know, who might win? Simone in one of her exit interviews was saying that in the middle of the night, Patrick would get up and be like, "Wake up, everybody! It's morning," and everyone would get up and. It would be the middle of the night. I think I would actually have killed him. Like, there's no way. As for all of the survivor rules of good gameplay, I would have voted him out for that alone. Like, sleep is such a precious commodity on Survivor. You're on these incredibly uncomfortable bamboo shelters. If someone woke me up from that with that, like, as like a prank, if I managed to not stab him, I might just ignore the rules of good gameplay.
Okay. William McQuaid wants to know, a lot was made of Patrick saying that he trusted most of his tribe instead of all. Why was that a big deal? He and everyone else voted someone else out who they presumably did not trust. Did you think that was much ado about nothing, Steven?
I definitely felt that was much ado about nothing. It's like one of those things where it's a completely generic statement. You know, Jeff easily could have been like, oh, most so telling, you know, like, oh, you know, the game is afoot. I guess that would be Tarzan who would say that. But you know, instead it became this like, oh my gosh, what a crazy slip from Patrick to not, you know, suggest that he trusts everyone in the tribe. And then I do actually think that that's representative of how Survivor works. It's like somewhat random things become the like built up in importance and then end up sort of defining the narrative of who someone is or how they act.
Okay. Stephen, finally, I did a lot of research before talking to you today because this is like a little bit different than what we normally do. And I went on an extensive fact-finding mission about you. And I have three things I would like to bring up.
Oh, my.
Okay. Number one interesting thing of note, Stephen Fishback has no Wikipedia proper page, which is unusual. I feel like that many survivors have a Wikipedia page. JT has an extensive Wikipedia page, yet there is no Wikipedia page on Stephen Fishback. Did you request to not have a Wikipedia page about you?
No. And in fact, I used to have a Wikipedia page.
And they deleted it?
Well, so there was a time when a ton of survivors had Wikipedia pages, many more, I think, than have them now. And some like malignant, like anti-fan went on and like contested all of these. Yeah. A hater went on and like contested all of these survivor wiki pages and got a lot of them deleted. I don't know the exact mechanism through which that happens, but like,
do you not exist?
I guess. I mean, it's just something. It's such a crazy mentality of like, you know what? Like, I can't, like, I'm going to spend my day destroying other people's Wikipedia pages. It's that it's almost better as a story or like some sort of insight into human nature than it is to have a Wikipedia page.
Okay. Interesting, false fact, alternative fact number two about Stephen Fishback. On the Stephen Fishback page on the Survivor Wiki, it states, in 2012, Stephen Fishback began co-hosting Survivor Know-It-Alls with Rob Cesternino when Nicole Cesternino, Rob's wife, was pregnant with their first child.
Wow, is that what happened?
No.
It's a whole other narrative.
There was no discussion of like, hey, Stephen, Nicole's knocked up. I need you to do the podcast.
Well, do you think that, I mean, I don't know. I have a very fraught relationship with the Survivor Wiki. Responsible for my downfall in Survivor Cambodia. But I've also done a Survivor Wiki like Q&A. So, you know, the Survivor Wiki and I, you know, who knows? Okay. It could just be like a gentle nudge in the ribs.
Okay. And number three, the final thing, I think this would be a fun game for people to play at home. Okay. So I looked at your IMDb page. Okay. See, and now I need you to know truth or misprint here. Okay. So just like on this, like not everything you read on the internet is true, despite what you hear. Okay. Is this fake news or not? See, I want people to play along, real news or fake news. Your IMDb, in addition to giving you credit for your outstanding work on Survivor in 2009 and in 2015, you are billed as the writer of Stevie Wonder with Friends, Celebrating a Message of Peace, a 2013 TV special. Is this true, or is this potentially a different Stephen Fishback? Is this fake news? People play along at home. What is Stephen going to answer? I'm going to guess that this ends up being real.
Should I say?
Yeah, say.
That is real. It was such a cool experience. It was a real career highlight. Some of you may know that one of the things I do is I am a speechwriter. And for a while, I was like the go-to speechwriter for BET. And they...
Makes sense.
Yes. They hosted this concert, Stevie, at the United Nations, dedicated to world peace. And so I had to write 9 speeches for Stevie Wonder, as well as other people. I wrote like for a number of other people who were there, like Sting was there. Malcolm Jamal Warner was there. Ban Ki-moon was there. I wrote a speech for Ban Ki-moon. Ban Ki-moon did not deliver that speech. But I did write one. So I guess I can always say I wrote for Ban Ki-moon. But I wrote 9 speeches for Stevie Wonder about world peace. And as interesting as it sounds, there are actually not 9 things to say about world peace. Mm-hmm.
And also kudos to you for your work back in 2013 that the world peace is well underway. you nailed it.
No, I mean, yeah, I guess if I had found 9 really compelling things to say, we might be there.
Yes.
No, but there's basically
like
one thing to say about world
things
peace.
Stephen Fishback wants you to know about Survivor Cambodia that was on CBS.com that I also read.
Yeah.
9 things Stevie Wonder wants you to know about world peace by Stephen Fishback.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay. Hard. No, it was fun. Like it was fun to like come up with like things about, you know, different angles into the subject of world peace. I could go on about this because it was really interesting. I mean, you know, being a speechwriter for Stevie, you know, what, first of all, like, how's he going to read the speech? Right. Obvious question. I figured he's a jazz musician. I don't need to bore you all with this. We can talk about my Stevie Wonder speech writing some other time. You're here for The Survivor.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Steven, I know you got to run. Thank you so much for everything. We'll save it for your hashtag Big Ted Talk.
Yeah.
Okay. Great job. This was very fun to do this outside of the normal construct of the know-it-alls. And I will see you next Wednesday.
Yeah, we really got a little bit more philosophical this time. This was fun.
Yeah, well, we don't have the chat room. I think that's what it is.
This was great. I really enjoyed this, Rob, and I'm sorry that I have to run.
Okay, no problem. Stephen Fishbeck, thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, there you have it. Stephen Fishbeck here on the Survivor Recap with me. A little bit of a quicker recap than we normally do, but we've got a lot of stuff coming up here in these next couple of days, and you're going to hopefully end up with a lot more than you bargained for. So I am going to be on my way to the Survivor match game tonight. It will be myself, David Wright, Hannah Shapiro, Aubrey Bracco, Nick Majorano, Aris Bushkauskas, and of course, Zeke Smith, all playing the match game against some RHAP listeners. We'll have that up for you guys in the podcast feed coming up over the weekend. And then I will also be talking with Angie Kontz on the Survivor archetype breakdown, which we normally do that in the preseason, but with everything going on with all the cast previews, we couldn't get to it until now. So we'll hear what Angie's system has to say. Plus, I will get into the voicemails with Akiva Winokur. Get your calls in. Rob has a website.com/voicemail or 323-282-RHAP for that show with Akiva, who him and I have just launched a new Curb Your Enthusiasm post-show recap over on postshowrecaps.com. And then finally, I will get into everything in the Wiggle Room with Josh, with special guest Aubrey Bracco. That show will be out on Tuesday morning for you guys to check out. So be on the lookout for everything in our podcast feed at robhasawebsite.com/iTunes. We really do appreciate your feedback and star ratings here at the start of the season. Genius Season 2 dropping on Monday, so be on the lookout for that as well. And with that, hope to see a bunch of you at the match game tonight. RHAP B&B and Why Simone Lost coming to the Rehab Ups feed over the weekend. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.